Welcome back, everyone, to ArcherCast number 183. The last episode we had was the first of going into, I guess, a second batch of people over the last few months since I was lucky enough to be granted a Nuffield scholarship. I made a point of interviewing everyone in the cohort. We have two more to go. Tonight I'll be interviewing the second last one after this episode, and then one more left, and we have interviewed everyone there. So if you want to go and look at everyone's stories or anyone in particular, just look them up as of probably the end of this month. They'll all be there. Yesterday or last week, I should say, we then thought, well, why not go back through the last bunch? So I jumped onto what is a big Nuffield database, which is what happens if you join Nuffield, a fantastic part of it. And basically everyone who has ever done Nuffield, you have contacts in countries all around the world, and it's quite fantastic. So I went to last year's, quite a lot of which I had seen present at the conference in November in Exeter. And that was Toby Simpson. Toby was talking about cover cropping, but we also got into the military, and I embarrassed myself because I know nothing about it. I said grenadier wrong. Everything went to pot. It was good fun. The next episode we have is an all-in episode with Ed and myself. Ed and I will be talking to Louisa Hendry. Louisa is the Scottish geologist. Oh, that was geologist, GEO, on Instagram. She's got a quarter of a million followers just talking about rocks. So, yeah, looking forward to that. I will know nothing because I know very little about rocks. I do a really nice rock collection at home with some amethysts and such like, some from near home and some from the gem shop. But looking forward to a few questions there that a few folk have asked me about different fault lines and stuff like that, which I will probably embarrass myself asking. And then today we bring on someone in that same cohort as the aforementioned Toby Simpson. And this gentleman actually will, of what I've just said to him off camera, will be mentioned when I do my final presentation for Nuffield, which is quite cool because everyone that presents at some point says, well, it seems like they say, I had a moment where things changed, or I had a sort of coin drop moment and a penny drop moment, whatever, and things sort of fell into place or whatever. And I had a pretty big moment about probably 24 hours before I was actually officially a Nuffield scholar, when Ollie was talking, they were doing the questions at the end, and he'd said something along the lines of he had a 14-year-old working with him, and it's a really good point, this, and I found it very interesting. And they were looking at going to study agricultural college, and he said, you're probably best bet not, and going to a Nuffield scholar's farm and just sort of learning that way, which was met with obviously quite a lot of agreement in the room. And that was my sort of moment. I was like, geez, agricultural education is up against it, and it's for good reason. So, yeah, Ollie's already had a sort of impact on my Nuffield scholarship, even though we had never spoken at that point. But today, I assume we'll be speaking for a bit of time. So, Ollie, would you like to say hello?
Evening. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Not at all, mate. Not at all. Looking forward to it. Just before we get started with another episode of the R2 cast, I would like to thank our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, formerly known as A-Plan Rural. Howden are heavily involved in the social media scene in the ag space with over 100,000 followers on Instagram. They use this following to host social media takeovers with farmers throughout the country to showcase their stories, as well as posting to their rural community blog with further articles about these people in the sector. On top of this, they like to support initiatives that are championing the British agricultural industry, such as myself. So thank you to Howden Rural for that.
And he's kind of shown me up. You guys can't see this because there's no video released, but he is at a standing desk, so he's very much going to be burning more calories than I am as this episode goes.
I have been in the office all day, just sat down, so I'm trying the standing up working.
It's better. Those standing desks are class, by the way. They're really
Yeah.
good. I would think I wouldn't do it, but I actually did somehow, which is quite good. I quite enjoy them. We've got one in the office that I tried to steal for a while, and then we unfortunately shifted offices. But for those listening, Ollie, that don't sort of know your story, could you just give them a bit of background about yourself, just even away from Nuffield and all that, just a bit of background about you?
I grew up in Somerset. We have to class ourselves, so I would be a first generation farmer. I guess my way into farming, we had a little small holding or hobby farm, if you like. It was 10 acres, and I was an engineer by trade, but loved to do. So we bought a house cow. So we had a Jersey house cow with a three-legged stool, and we used to hand milk her, and that was very early on. my memory of farming, and I guess I just fell in love with it there. So we used to go to the local cattle market and buy steers, and Dad used to let me buy one with my pocket money and help. I mean, I think it was subsidized quite heavily by him,
I was probably.
yeah, and then I guess reading back now, what influences you from the ages from 3 to 7? If you look at trauma in kids or happy kids, there's quite a lot. What happens in that period shapes quite a lot what you do in life. Quite interesting because Dad had kidney failure, so we had dialysis at home when we were growing up. So he used to sit in a chair for 4 hours, 3 days a week. With massive needles in his arm, and from that, my sister's become a doctor. So maybe her seeing that has influenced her that way. And if you speak to her, she'd say like she became a doctor from dad's
Right.
to help. But for me, it was just farming. I just loved being outside, loved being practical. But then my journey for education went from doing a degree in agriculture because my parents were like, well, you need to learn how to do it. And in those days, did a degree in agriculture quite high. And then went traveling for a year and then set out working for a guy up in Wiltshire because I learned quite quickly in Somerset, everyone was fighting for 5 acres or 1 acre of land. And then I went into this massive place called Wiltshire that seemed to have abundance of fields and grassland not doing anything, which I just started knocking on doors and renting little bits of ground. I've started with 90 giraffe sheep in 2008. And currently we have 600 Romney sheep, 50 beef shorthorn Supper cows, 480 dairy cows on a share farming with King's Cross Estates, Tim May. And then we're helping manage another farm of 250 Viking Reds. So yeah, there's been a big bit of growth in there, and we've been very lucky and very fortunate, and there's a lot of hard work in there.
I think a big bit of growth is somewhat of an understatement.
it just happened. Yeah, just from that connection, that knowledge, working hard, doing a good job. It kind of just snowballed eventually.
We'll get into that side quite soon, Alex. It's a massive part, and it's pretty
Yeah.
impressive. From the sort of small amount I know, but purely because of what we just spoke about, tell us about your experience at Agricultural College.
So when I was there, it was pre-phones, so
A different job there, a completely different gig.
yeah. There's no video evidence of what we got up to, which I think is a big part of today's problem is they just never get to relax, let their
Well,
hair
yeah.
down as such. So my education, I guess at the time, it got me to where I am now because of the networking and the people I met. So that's how I met the people that farmed in Wiltshire. So they said, come up and do a harvest job. So without that degree, I would still probably be in Somerset fighting for 5 acres, or I probably wouldn't have even had the mindset I could farm. So it's definitely got me to where I am today. I question it today, but at the time when I did it, it was a free education, and it was a great laugh. I did learn, but looking back, I didn't learn anything about marketing, and I didn't really understand how a business works. But I learned the practicality
Smart.
of things in a book that was dated 1980, and I was there in late 90s. So I guess maybe I was learning practices that actually I follow now because we have kind of gone back to basics of what our farming systems are. There's nothing new in agriculture. We've just gone back to basics of the lower cost system. So those books probably are true to me now. But it's like that old thing that the lecturer there standing up reading you a book that's 20 years old. It's interesting, but what I got out of it was a friendships for life and a network base of people,
But
and a
also,
degree.
well, yeah. Also, even considering that sort of scenario you say there, I mean, I can't visualize a lecturer reading a book to students like that. That just, how boring does that sound?
It's
Oh
not.
my God.
I know.
I was actually just, when you were talking there, I was just quickly glancing back to Instagram to, because I knew I'd written something about your presentation at Nuffield on my Instagram during the day, and I just wanted to quickly read something that I'll just about ask later basically. But one thing that popped out was a class I created that I thought was quite interesting. But when you look at that sort of stand up and either read a board or read a book, or I'm like, that is, you can't learn anything. You, well, I couldn't. That's mad to me. That's just insane. Very backwards, I think. But yeah, I can see why the issue has arised, in fairness. But yeah. So after you've got to this stage, Ollie, where you've been like, well, we're gonna buy, it was 90 sheep to kick off, wasn't it? Yeah.
90 draft sheep at £32, I think they were.
Oh, yeah, pretty good going. What was that process itself like? Were you, I think you were still working at this point, or
Yet still very much fully employed.
I would just like to quickly interrupt the show for a minute to give you some extra information about our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, the new name for A Plan Rural. Howden Rural provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. Be sure to check out Howden Rural today.
Working on a large arable contracting estate, which we did a lot of straw baling, which got me out on a lot of farms. So that's another gem, you see. I went to, in the summer, we'd go to like 20 or 30 farms. So I got to meet all the farmers. I got a rapport with them. I also got to see what they looked like, their land. Whereas I guess if I was stuck on one farm, I wouldn't have seen all those opportunities. So when people asked me how I did it, I was like, well, I work for a contractor because you're going to go and see all these farms. And then you get to meet the farmer. And then he might, hear you get a conversation going, and then he says, "Oh, I've got this bit of land, or someone's leaving, or do you know such and such his farm's coming up for rent?" Whereas I think if you're stuck on one farm, you don't see that opportunity.
Oh, that's true. That's it. You're seeing, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So a feed rep, or not that you get reps anymore, but you need to be going out. You need a job role somewhere where you can network and gain that knowledge and build those relationships. And it is like courting to be a marriage, basically, in those early age, those early days, you are very much showcasing yourself,
For sure.
what you can do. Because you
And I
don't,
think,
because I didn't have anything else before. It's not like I could say, "Come and look at my farm, look how I do these sheep." It was all at face value of what I looked like. There wasn't, I had no reputation. I had no farm. You couldn't say I've sold my sheep for a high market price. It was just me. So I was very conscious of that, of which is what I've said in my presentation. I had a massive advantage being the first generation farmer because I had to take that risk and I had to put myself out there.
That's a really interesting take on it. Really interesting take on it.
So the big thing is that we need first generation farmers in our industry because they are the risk takers, they are the bold ones, they are the ones that are innovative and do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So did you just see someone with sheep that they were wanting to get rid of sheep, and you were happy to take them, or how did that come about?
No, again, another uni friend was working for FRAG. WAG, WAG is it?
Wag, yeah, I never knew how you
WAG.
said it. Yeah.
FWAG. So he bought the sheep with me originally, because he knew a farm, a very good Romney breeder, the Hoskins over in Sussex, and he'd managed to live near them or something. So he said, "Oh, I found some sheep." So he approached me basically and said, "If I hear you're going to buy some sheep, do you want to do it with me?" So Reese and I were in business for probably 3 years, and then basically he went on, so I bought him out after 3 years. So again, there was a little partnership there to leapfrog me up. And it helped me in those early days because we were both fully employed. So we both had that flexibility of one could check them in the morning. And then after year three, I think we were up to like 350 sheep. And then we got to 400 sheep. And then it just got too much. It was almost like that relationship that I had with my boss was really good and open. But it was just getting to that point where you could see that it was just going to break.
Yeah, for sure.
I just had a meeting and said, "Look, I don't want to leave, but if this is going to work, I need to jump off the cliff." And he was like, "Well, how are you going to make a living?" And I said, "I don't know. I know this is going to end wrong. I'm either going to do the sheep bad and lose my reputation, or we're going to fall out, which I don't want to do. So I left, and then my friend had a marquee company, so I put up some marquees, which is brilliant because I could just do it when I wanted. It wasn't like two farms working alongside each other in pressure times.
Yeah, exactly. Is jump off the cliff
Well,
the
jump off the cliff,
same?
having taking the rug away from you. If you've got a, I had a house at my job, very well paid job, salary, very highly regarded, and I was just like going from that to 400 sheep that wasn't going to get paid for 8 months because I had to wait for the lamb to grow. So,
Talk about risk, Jesus.
yeah, but I didn't have, I wasn't married, didn't have any children, so. When you calculate the risk, it was only me, only my
Affords you
pride, I
that
guess.
leniency, doesn't it? It affords you that ability to be like, well, if it goes wrong, it only affects me.
Yes, exactly. And my pride's damaged, and I'd have to probably, go back and find a job.
Yeah, for sure.
But I guess you back your own ability, to do that.
What was
So,
the process in that time there, Ollie, where you've went from 90 to 300 sheep? What was getting land? Was that easy? Was that difficult? Or
So we managed to we secured 120 acres in that first bout, just from ringing round, and then someone said, "Oh, there's 125 acres." Because I was looking for 10 acres. This is what my vision was: 10 acres and 10 sheep, and and then started like a little market garden and butchery and all that. That's where I was going with this. And then they're like, "How many sheep have you got?" And I was like, "None." The landlord backed me, I had a really good chat with the landlord on day one, and I guess he wanted, the underdog. Everyone loves the underdog. I guess there was a bit of that, and he said, well, we'll let him have a go. And then the neighboring farm saw me, and I helped him out, and he was, managed to be 65 and retiring. It's just like it all married up. It's almost like you could write that script, and it's all for a valley. So there's 1400 acres now on that sheep and beef unit. I've got seven landlords, so like marrying up seven landlords is quite tricky because they've all got their own personalities and they've all got their own way of doing things. And it's just straight through this valley, and we've just bolted them all together over the years. Just from reputation, they see you're doing a good job, and they're like, "Well, let him have a go." And it just happened that three people were giving up, and we just so we haven't taken any, we've never pushed anyone out. They've kind of given up or retired. Or no longer done it, so it's all been quite amicable,
Ethical rental.
which is quite nice. I always thought you'd have to stand on someone's toes, but we've never actually stood on anyone's toes
Yeah,
to do it.
that's quite nice, actually.
And interestingly, two of the people, they're probably in their 70s now, they do check the sheep. I employ a guy down there. There's some people that do check the sheep that used to work on the land, so that's quite nice.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it is, but they were sort of ready to finish, but still a connection there is quite nice. No.
It is, and it's all about that community, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sustainability is about community and the local community.
And you've obviously moved away from where you originally started. How far is that? I'm terrible at English geography.
So yeah, so from Somerset, it's an hour and a half to Wiltshire, and now where the dairy is at Kingsclere, we're 40 minutes away from the sheep. So the
Okay.
sheep are in Salisbury, and we're in Hannington, Kingsclere, so near Basingstoke.
But none of this is helping.
Yes.
The duration, the time was amazing. That was
Yeah.
perfect. That's what I was after.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, about 40 minutes away. When we set up for the dairy, the intention was to stay with the sheep. We had good friends down there. We settled down there. And then it nearly killed me the first calving of the Beast of the East. I was driving 40 minutes up here, calving 180 heifers outside. And then quickly realized that it was going to work. It needed our full attention. So we moved the family up here in the April of 18.
I was 18, yeah, 18, yeah.
Yeah. So, and again, it just married up that the village, the other farm in the village where the sheep are, had like a 200 acre arable farm and a son who was been helping me from the age of about 14 at lambing time. And he'd come to 18, 19 year old. And he wanted a job, and it just married up that he could slot in down there.
Perfect.
I mean, I chucked him in at the deep end. You know, there were some big mistakes down there that we had to ride. And you know, it took it out of him a bit as well because you know he was kind of left to it. And so when it went wrong, he felt it was his fault. It wasn't. It was just that we had to go through just those mistakes. But this dairy where the debt was on, so this needed my attention.
Well, let's focus on the sheep quickly, and then we'll jump to dairy because the dairy is definitely not conventional.
No.
It would be fair to say, which is interesting, obviously. Very much like your story about the lady on your, I believe it was in Zimbabwe, trying to sell her.
The Australian girl.
Oh, it was Australian, was it? Sorry.
She blew my mind. If you had your light bulb moment of what I said, then she just, yeah. I was been looking, everyone said this light bulb moment. And I was like, yeah, what is that? And maybe not, I don't know if it's a light bulb, but it was kind of my moment where I went, yeah, what am I messing around with?
We'll come to that because it's a great
Yeah.
story. Apart from the fact I got not only the nationality but the continent wrong. So the sheep side, what's the sheep sitting at now, Ollie? Sorry.
600 breeding Romney ewes.
Why
So
Romney? Out of interest.
Romney, yeah, Romney.
Why Romney?
We wanted so in my basic farming, like I don't like the word regenerative, but I've managed to become a regenerative farmer by default. I was doing it bloody in 18, sorry, in 2015, 2005, sorry. Basically, I wanted a low input sheep. We didn't have any buildings. I needed a sheep that would lamb outside. New Zealand have a lot of Romneys. The guy that we bought them off, who, like I said, my friend farmed down the road, just so happened to be one of the top Romney breeders in the country. So we bought his stock. We went there for an afternoon. He blew our mind of like, it just made sense to me. We don't need any concentrates. We don't need buildings. You don't need labor. You don't need light llamas. And when you're setting up a business, it's about cash flow. So we've become a low input farmer because we couldn't borrow the money. And so we've fallen into this, which every first generation farmer would have to do unless they got a massive capital backing. So that style of farming. So that Romney sits us, get a lamb at like 1.6% outside. So I had this little garage that had five lambing pens. So once I'd got five ewes in, that was it. So then I had been lambing before when I put five in there, and then I had to let one back out because this one was more important than that one. But it's a good discipline because we're culling. It's really good discipline from the start. If I had a massive barn and loads of money, I would put them all inside. I'd have had night lambers. I'd have spent all this money on gate, and I'd still probably be doing the system now because I've always done it. But I'd probably bred a sheep that's not viable because it needs hands on. Whereas I've bred a sheep by default that doesn't need any handling.
I always see it as sort of almost advancing that parabola, you know. Sort of moving it forward every year, which is such a basic way of putting it, but I think it's a brilliant analogy. And am I right in saying, I would not go as far as saying make money, but you won't lose money on wool with Romneys either.
No, it's getting a bit tight at the moment. The last
Right.
2 years, it did go really good. We started shearing twice a year, and then we soon stopped that when the labour price went up and the shearing. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's pretty. Ooh, I think we may have lost money last year on the shearing. It'd be a bit touch and go.
But I mean, like,
Everyone.
normally it's just a complete, like, you don't even know what you, I mean, you don't even really care what's coming in. But Romney, there's a bit of a market for it.
Yeah, and I still I'm holding firm that this wool will have a market. I just think
Okay.
there's a natural, I don't know. I mean, everyone's going to wool shedding sheep, and maybe we should be going that way. But I just holding off that. I think it's a natural product. It's got to have some use somewhere. I don't know.
Seems. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word blasphemous, but it seems mad that a product like wool is just burnt, being buried, being this.
You look at the history of wool and the estate homes that are made of wool and the wool trade.
100%.
There's so much money in wool, and
It's
now it's worthless. I
got
just think, I don't
better
know.
than nylon or something like that as well. Like, it's got, I know it's expensive, but why is it expensive when it's not expensive? Actually, now I say that out loud.
Don't know. That's the economics of wool farming.
I know. Well, is there not only four countries in the world that have any form of wool industry from a farming perspective, I think.
I think it was four when I was doing my master's. But so how many people are involved in the sheep side? Just yourself, you and
And Philip, who runs it, he's a 20. Ooh, Philip would be 24 now or
Okay.
25. 24, 25. So
And
he
that
runs
Philip
it.
you just mentioned too started at 15
Yep.
and
So he
oh,
started.
brilliant. Thank you.
He's still there. So now he started to buy the sheep. So he's bought maybe 150 of them today.
Okay.
I very much wanted to put back down. It's very important to me that people help me up the
Sure.
ladder. So now I'm putting back down the ladder and giving him the opportunity because now we're doing really well up here. Like, when you question why I've got it, is it out of greed? You know, it makes money. Is it greed? I'm keeping it. What, like, is it a good pub talk that I've got it? It's kind of like I've reassessed why I've got it and why I'm doing it because Philip does all the work. I go down there maybe once a month, which, you know, was once a week and then once a fortnight. Now it's once a month. And then at calving time, I might not even go down there. But he'll do the whole of lambing without seeing
Yeah.
me. If he left, I'd probably sell it anyway because I wouldn't find another Philip. So then it's like, well, why doesn't I just let him have it? Like
So
buy into it,
is
buy
your
into it with me.
goal to allow him to buy 100% over time or up to 50?
Yeah, I think so. The only reservation I've got of that is I've got two young children, and if one of my children are diehard sheep farming people, and I'd hate to say, oh, I used to have a business. So it's maybe a conversation to have for Philip when we get up to 80%.
Yeah.
Like, I'd let him have 80% for sure, yeah, easily.
That's pretty commendable because I don't even know if I have that in me. That's really nice. Maybe I do, I don't know.
We've been up here 5 years now, and then you kind of like are reassessed of like we kept it to start with. If this failed, like we'd have your legs and go back to Wiltshire and then forget we ever became a dairy farmer and deny all knowledge and just become a sheep farmer again. Now I would say I am a dairy farmer.
Was dairy the
Yeah.
goal? Or was dairy the goal or was farming the goal?
Farming's a goal.
Okay,
Farming's a goal. Yeah,
anything.
definitely. Yeah, farming's a goal. Always, obviously, going back to that house cow, Jersey cow, and always when you study business, you look where the money is in farming, and dairy's, you know, more profitable than sheep and beef. So, a massive stretch for a first generation farmer to become a dairy farmer.
For
So,
sure.
yeah. So the goal was to be a farmer in my own right. So it was anything really. And obviously, sheep are the easiest thing to get into. You don't have to worry about TB. The capital's a lot less. You know, when a cow dies, it hurts. When a sheep dies, it's kind of, yeah.
Let's hope one of your kids doesn't grow up to like sheep and hear
Exactly.
that.
Yeah. So that, yeah. So effectively, yeah, it's a conversation, Philip. At the moment, it's, yeah, he can carry on buying them.
For sure, yeah. I will say that I'm very much of the sheep side and maybe have the emotional leniences more to the sheep, but
Yeah, I guess it's because I never really had,
had them.
you know, my children might have a completely different, they probably will have this mindset because they're a second generation farmer. So they will have a different mindset to what I had, I expect.
So you've got the sheep enterprise.
Yep.
Well, we understand how it comes about, but what I guess again, what's the process involved in then starting up a dairy enterprise?
Right. So that. The sheep we're doing, yeah, so we're doing really well down there. We're turning money, we're making money, we're investing, we're growing. Not going to get rich. You know, are we going to buy a house in Wiltshire? It's going to take us a long time. Where the sheep is, and it was a lot of hard graft. We couldn't employ anyone. So like going on holiday always hurt because I had to get casuals in to pay them to cover. Although the older generation did it, but it's still. You know, if you went on holiday, it's kind of eating into that profit. And I hated that mindset that it started to own me. And I didn't want the business to own me. But then, so Tim May at Kingsford Estate, I went to school with him. I hadn't seen him for 20 years because this is before Facebook and mobile phones and stuff. So we kind of left school and said, yeah, you know, we are friends, but we didn't see each other. He lived over in Hampshire and I lived in Somerset. So that was a long way away then. he had an advert in the Farmers Weekly, and I didn't even buy the Farmers Weekly, but I by chance saw an advert in there. It said 1,000 acres of purple ley looking for a grazier. That's all it said, a grazier. So I was like, oh, I'm sure I went to school with Tim. I would come up to Kingsclere to have a catch up, basically, to have a look what he was doing. I never had any intention to apply for it because it was just too big a 1,000 acres at the time. I think we might have been probably 500 acres. It's all like rough ground. It's 1,300 acres of sheep ground, but it's all hillland, and
For sure,
you can't
for
get a
sure.
tractor on half of it. So I came up, and Tim was like, "Are you going to apply?" And I was like, "Oh, Tim, I'd love to apply, but it's me. It needs a dairy. It's crying out for a dairy." And there were sheep there at the time, and I said, "Look, you need 5,000 sheep or whatever. I can't borrow the money, and I wouldn't borrow the money for 5,000 ewes. I just wouldn't. I didn't have the confidence in the sheep trade." So he said, "Are you going to apply?" And I said, "No." So then he said, "Oh, something together." So I did a rough the rough thing and sent it through. And anyway, so it went to someone else. And then 2 years later, he texted me, "So you're still interested in the dairy?" And I said, "Yeah, always interested in looking at it." But Tim's done his Nuffield, so he's a very interesting person. You'd love to get him on your podcast because he'll
What
blow
was
your
that
mind.
on? Is Nuffield? What was
Sustainability.
okay.
Sustainability back in, he might have been 2011. So he did it quite early. So he saw very early on that his state was depleting soils, that was like killing stuff, and just wanted to regenerate his estate.
Yeah, for sure.
So hence the herbal leys, hence the livestock are in there to manage the herbal leys to grow carbon, soil, whatever. So Tim wanted it to cover every inch of the farm. So he was a mixed farm. They had a dairy, they had a pig unit, and they had arable, but it wasn't mixed because it never went round everything. So the term mixed farming, as everyone said, that's mixed farming. It's not really mixed farming because they don't interlink. So the silage
That's
of
a very good
straw.
point. Yeah, it's just different. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I've never really thought about it, and Tim explained it, but if you look at his farm, all the resources of straw from the arable come into the dairy. But because it was wet or laziness, it just went back on the fields around the dairy. So it never came back out, and the cows never grazed where the dairy was. So when Tim set this whole share farming agreement up, the only stipulation I've got is I have to go on every inch of the estate.
Okay, yeah.
It's 2,500 acres. I don't know, it's probably 5 kilometers from one end to the next. So there's no cow tracks. It's only a 5-year agreement. All my dairy friends were like, "Oh, get him to put it in there. He's got the money." And I was like, "Well, no, he's why I can't tell him to spend £1 million on a 5-year entity, like unknown entity, and
Sure.
nor can I borrow the money to do it." So that's when Tom and Neil were doing the mobile, who are still home with me in Dorset. And I took him down there to see them to say we can go mobile milking, which Tim loved the idea of mobile. He likes everything to be mobile anyway, so we can move. And then we set that up, and then I couldn't get a milk contract in 17. No one picked the phone up to me, except Arla and Omsko on an organic contract.
Okay.
We weren't organic. And so I rang Tim and said, "Oh, I can't do it. I can't get a milk contract, but I can get an organic one." And then the next day, Tim emailed me saying, "Yeah, I've filled in now. We're organic. What's next?"
I thought it was a quite a long process, is it not? I thought it was a
As in, like, he's registered to do it. So we could
right.
backdate. It's in 17. So we could, he hadn't put a lot of inputs in. So we could do it. So basically, the estate's in 8 cropping blocks.
Okay.
So we put one block in. We're fully organic now, but we put a block in to start with. And then we started milking in 18. So we could go, as long as the heifers were there 6 months before. It's just his mindset of was just like most landlords would probably just walk away.
Sure, yeah.
It's as much as a landlord as in Tim, as in me, that this partnership works because we're both open-minded to make it work.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So yeah, he put his and now the whole estate's organic basically. And we haven't looked back since. So we started with 180 heifers in the Beast of the East in 18. Which, yeah, the milking parlour froze halfway through milking. Horrendous weather. I'd rather have it now. I'd rather, looking back, it's great to have that in that first period because it tested the system to the whole. nothing could be as bad as that April
Yeah,
or
for sure.
March. And luckily, we didn't have 100 cows in that first year. We only had 160 heifers to get through. I did it all on my own. I had one guy help me for calving, and then I did the whole year on my own on the cash flow. And then we just bred up everything. Everything went back to a Jersey to get the numbers to get up to 400. And then we took that bounce back loan to pay back some debt early. And then we're free in year four.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So from nothing to owning everything. Tim owns half the cows. I own the other half, and I own all the equipment. If you tip Tim's farm upside down, all my bits will come off.
For sure.
Apart from the facility that I've built, which is a which is an ongoing discussion of, I've improved this soil for probably the next generation. That's why I'm here, basically. I'm here as a fertility, not here as a dairy farm. I'm here as a fertility building for the estate and the soil and the carbon to feed the soil.
Which
So,
is now something that exists. If you
yes.
said that 20 years ago, folk would have been like,
Yeah.
no,
Yeah,
I
what are you
want
doing? You
number
need to rape that soil, you need to produce
one.
a product. Whereas we look at it, that milk is a really high density nutrient product, but it's almost a byproduct of what we're trying to achieve on the bigger picture of sustainability.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly.
So everyone said, have I been a dairy farmer before? I worked in New Zealand for 8 months on a farm, on a dairy farm. And when I was 16, I worked on a traditional 80 cow dairy farm. But on both systems, I was just putting cups on. I wasn't managing the farm. But all I've done is taken that knowledge of sheep farming and moved it into a cow. So if you put me on a 12,000 litre Holstein three times a day milking, I'd probably break it in a day because I wouldn't understand the complexity of feeding that cow.
For
So
sure.
we get very few health problems. I've never lifted a cow's foot in 5 years. We don't get any GAs, we don't get very little mastitis because it's a very extensive lower output, low input system. So our cows are really healthy animals because they're not pushed. So our mindset and our well-being for ourselves and our staff and our cows all go together.
There's a book, and I have not read it. I've not really read a book before at all, to be honest. But a book called Animal Machines by Ruth Harrison, which was written in the 1960s, and it was about the whole concept of, and I don't like the term, but the factory dairy, the intensive dairy.
Yeah.
And I don't have as big an issue with it as a lot of activists do, but I see the issue. It's
Yeah.
you say 12,000. There's full herds knocking 16 and 17 now. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
that's mental. And I don't think it's right, actually.
No, like, not here to diss anyone's system, and there's many ways to produce food. But it's just what you're comfortable with doing. Like I said, my cash flow wouldn't allow me to build that system.
For sure, yeah.
Maybe now we've got some credibility with some bank and some lending, we could probably go into that system, but why would I? Yeah, I wouldn't. I don't want that system.
So, when you say mobile dairy, what do you mean?
So everything literally is mobile, from the water trough to the parlor to the tank to the generator. So it's basically in a field. It lives in the field. So we calve on the 10th of March. The next question everyone is, oh, that must be cold in January. It probably is, but I'm not out there.
I was
So
expecting that you weren't, in fairness. I was the calving question was coming.
yeah, so we can't so we understand the system. We're not greedy with our milk. So this year, December is awful wet. In December we just dried the cows off. So we normally dry them off 1st of December. Stipulation from my wife Trish on day one was, you're not milking on Christmas Day,
Okay,
because she was
yeah.
like, I don't see you anymore as a sheep farmer. And I was like, no, I'm trying to convince her that you'll see more of me, because this is going to be, I can employ people, we can have time off, we can have more money. And she didn't believe me, because she's like, you work crazy hours as a sheep farmer. And she's like, you're not milking Christmas Day. So the stipulation I have is I cannot milk Christmas Day. Dry them off in December. We don't start again till March. So there's probably 2 weeks in March where it's not very pleasant, and it's probably a week in November. But when I set out, I had this envision that I'd have two buckets of hot water at either end of the parlor. So it's a 20-40 herringbone. So it's a big old parlor. And I had hot water buckets at either end, and every time I'd just dip my hands in there. And I can honestly say to this day, I've never been cold in there.
Really? Right.
And there's two girls that work with me. They're in their 20s, and they've never, well, they haven't left yet.
They're still there. Yeah, brand here is a pretty good indicator. How mobile is a parlor of that size? How does it, in my head, I can't work that out, to be honest.
Okay, so it doesn't really do gateways. So
Okay.
it's 17 foot wide, and it's 50 foot long. So
How long, sorry?
50 foot, I think it is.
50, okay.
Yeah. So Tim's arable farm is average size field is probably 80 to 100 acres.
Yes.
So we've divided the field up into 6 hectare grazing platform blocks with just single high tensile wire. So whenever it's mobile, moving it miles every day, it lives with the cows, and the cows have 6 hectares a day, probably roughly for the year. So we probably move it 200 meters a day. So it just
Okay.
goes in front of the cows. So it takes about 40 minutes to move. So it's just on 8 hydraulic legs. So it hooks up to a truck. The hydraulic pipes in, and then
Right.
pull up 8 legs, and then go. So the collecting yard is electric wire. So they stand behind electric wire. Very little. It has to be simple to work outside, and it's four pipes that connect to each other, and then it just moves on to the next block.
Brilliant. I'll be
Very
honest, you
simple.
spoke about it with your you spoke about it in your presentation, and I said to Yaz, my partner, I was like, I don't get it. I don't understand that at all. How many of that is there in the UK? Do you know?
That's it. Tom and Neil have got one in Dorset, and then there's another one over in the east, and then there's one up in the Cotswolds of this size one, like systems. But then small ones in Somerset, there's quite a few.
Right, okay.
Yeah, there's quite a few. So the milking bell was designed by Hosier to go up over the Wiltshire Downs, basically when they wanted to milk more far away from the farm, basically. So there's still a few of them go out in the summer and then come in the winter and milk inside. So you'd be surprised how many mobile milkers
Yeah.
there are out there.
Well, we came across not the same at all, but somewhat related. Mobile dairy when we were in Rwanda in August, and it was not a mobile dairy in that there was a physical dairy. It was they walked with the cows and milked them and took them to a very fancy dairy, actually, in the middle of a field, in the middle of the hills in Rwanda. It was quite an experience to milk some pretty random cows in the middle of a random field that we'd walked about an hour to get to. It was really fun, really.
Yeah.
And what was really enjoyable was they said, "Yeah, we're getting about 14 liters." We were looking at the rudders, thinking, "You're not,
That's just no.
absolutely no chance that's happening."
14.
Which was pretty entertaining, but
Yeah.
no.
Now I did have a Zimbabwean, oh no, a Kenyan guy looked at it. And he fell in love with it, and he wanted to take it back to his village. They all have two cows or one cow, and
For
his
sure.
plan was to have the in the community, and everyone would walk their cow and hire like a pay as you go, which I could see working if you go bring your cow and milk it on the system. But he just said they would all fight or something, so it never.
It would be tricky to manage that, though, wouldn't it? It
Yeah,
would probably
exactly.
need to be a smaller one as opposed to the one you've got.
I
And
could say ours is too big for that because you like say it's 1 liter or 3 liters they give. It's in the system. How do you get it?
it'd be quite tricky, that actually.
You need to milk the whole villages before you can start getting milk out. That's the
Is it spread evenly, or do you know exactly what your cow's going to get? Yeah, that's a tricky one. So tell us about Nuffield, Ollie. Well, first off, I think it's important to mention you mentioned ladder earlier. Yours is termed, is it living the farming ladder? Is that right?
yeah, living the
Oh.
farming ladder because right, the whole Nuffield for me. So I went when I'd done my degree and I'd done my travelling, and then I went to like the country shows, and there was a Nuffield stand there, and I looked at it then and thought, oh, that looks amazing. Go travelling. Because I'd just done travelling, I thought, oh, cool, I can go and do this. And then I looked at it then, and I was probably 23, 24, and I thought, oh no, I don't think I'm right for that. Which I'm glad because I don't think I would have been at that stage for me. I don't think I would have got enough out of it.
Sure.
So then, obviously, Tim's done his nut field. So working alongside Tim, he was a big influence to say, you should do it. You need to do it. So then, when we looked at doing it, I felt it all. Tim's like pushing me. So I did it all, and then I said to Tim, "Well, what's my? I need to do it on something." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that. It's about the person. Just get it in there." And I said, "Yeah, but I need to put something in this box."
Ollie Chedji is my application. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. Just go with it. You'll be
Yeah.
fine. So then I, then it was like, well, what are you interested in? And for me, it was almost like helping other thing back down is more important to me than me going forward, because there's so many people that have helped me, like from those old people that on the weekend for me or gone to pick up something to my dad, who did a lot for me before he died. The whole community that backed me, and that, and so I just wanted to somehow understand. Not a blueprint, because there isn't a blueprint to first generation farming, because it's all your own journey. You do create your own luck, and you do create your own knowledge and relationship. But is this somehow I could try and understand what I'd done to help people? So then we just put the farming ladder. Then someone had already done that. So I was like, well, why don't you do a living farming ladder? Because then you could also look at how you progress through the ladder effectively.
It was Michael Blanch that coined it, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, but then Ian Henderson had written a book on it.
okay.
But yeah, so but I don't know if he got that from then. So yeah, so I went to see Michael. Had a great afternoon with Michael, actually.
He's a hilarious idiot,
Oh
isn't
yeah, no, it was great comedy. And then
he?
I learned a lot then to research the person you speak to, because I didn't even know he had a podcast.
Yeah, he does. It's a good one.
It's
It's
a very good
long.
one.
Like, if you're a nerd for what he's talking about, that is a play. And in fairness, if you're interested in his story and you're listening to this podcast and you want to hear that, I have spoke to Michael as well. I think it was number 81. And it's funny, like you say, like I can't remember if it's recorded or if it was off camera, but I'd maybe been on the camera on the phone call 2 minutes, and he called me an arsehole. And I'm like, this guy is my guy. Like this is what I want.
Yeah.
So sorry, yeah, you're up with
Yeah,
Michael.
no, he, I just felt I needed to see him maybe more out of respect
For sure, yeah.
or, and this is like some helpful tips, where to go and where not to. So yeah, went up to see Michael, had a great afternoon with him and an evening with him, actually evening meal. But he, what I learned from Michael is that 3-year-old to 7-year-old emotion, and I found his whole living farming ladder was more about emotion of farming, which I hadn't really gone too deep into, I suppose, in myself. So I did learn quite a lot from Michael, but I always looked at it as business side of it, of how I could help people through business. But yeah, there's quite a lot of an emotional attachment to farming, and when you look at other businesses, we seem to be attached to this land. Which is probably more, because someone's worked hard for it, and I think the generations, the second, third, fourth generation to whatever, some of them are too scared to lose that legacy or to make a mistake with it, that it becomes an emotional, some people headache and some people a treasure. I don't know. It's
It can cripple some folk, but it also can, I guess, make if
yeah,
all they're looking for.
exactly. And it's understanding that. Is there some way of teaching those people or mentoring those people that have got that? Because I looked at them and I was jealous of them. But now looking at them, oh, they've got so much on their shoulders, it's got shackles on them. And so sometimes they don't release their full potential because of of how they look at the risk.
It's I think there's a lot of weight on the weight the parents put. 'Cause I mean, look, I'm at least mum and dad decide they want to give it the cats. I'm probably heir to what's an 800 hectare estate, about 40, probably 2 or 3% of which is owned.
Okay.
And don't be wrong, it's not amazing ground. There's some nice ground in it, but what they've also been like is like, well, like do what you want. You have your career. And if you want this at the end, we'll work at that when we come to there. Whereas I do have friends in a similar position to me. However, it's here, you've got to come back. And they don't get a chance to live their life at all. Yet they've got this sort of probably folk have an opinion of, oh, they've got this £1 million heirloom coming. But if, in my head, and £1 million heirloom means nothing if it comes with family pressure.
No,
Like, nothing.
no.
Yeah.
It's almost a, yeah, almost like a disadvantage.
100%. Yeah, there is a part of it.
So it was interesting, Michael. That's what I learned from Michael. But yeah, so my Nuffield, so it was kind of like doing that, helping putting that down, probably taking stock because I haven't really stopped. And we'd obviously, like, the sheep was quite a slow burner. And then on my presentation, we had this bell graph that everyone laughed at my of how I did it. It's very true that if you don't look at it like a ladder, if you look at it more like a bell graph and a business curve, you kind of stagger along, and then all of a sudden that growth has happened, and a lot of people stop before that growth happens.
I'm looking at it next. I've got the photo on my phone from the day. Oh, isn't it? Yeah, it's really good. It makes so much sense.
It's just trying to make it simple and kind of put it back in a business brain and take the emotional side out of it. I guess is what I was trying to explain it. I tried to make it as simple as possible because you could go into so many depths of net profit and capital and per hectare and per output and all this and different enterprises you need to do, or I could just strip it right back to try and make it as simple as you could do in a 10-minute presentation.
I hope you've kicked your feet up and got comfy and enjoying another fantastic episode of the R2 Cast with another really interesting guest. I would just like to quickly take another second to plug the sponsors of the show today, The Scottish Farmer, and I would strongly advise you to go out and pick one up this week and see even more of the fantastic people that are in our industry.
Well, 10 minutes is not long.
No,
This
it's
is
not long. It's not
no,
long. When
it's
I started writing, I was like, oh, what am I going to say for 10 minutes? And then I was like, oh no, what? I can't say what I want to say.
Remember, my career is for speaking for 6 hours a day. So, yeah, 10 minutes. Jesus, discuss nonsense for 10 minutes. So, yeah. Well,
Yeah, so I didn't really. So I set off on this journey. Yeah, so it's like, oh. We got enough field, and then it blew my mind. The CSE really opened my mind up that there's a lot of first generation farmers out there, and a lot of successful people. And then you're just welcomed into this massive family of network people. You get this whole book of everyone that's done enough field around the world, and I'm sitting there thinking, wow, my children can have, this is my children. They can go anywhere in the world from this network because once you say the word enough field, they're like, yeah, come and see me.
for sure. Yeah.
And
Well,
even if I say my dad did enough field 20 years ago, they'd be like, yeah, come and see me.
Oh, did your dad? Oh, sorry. No,
No,
no. Go.
sorry. Yeah, sorry. That's what, yeah.
Go. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was one massive bonus that I've got out of it. And just the people I've met along the way. So, so we went to Zimbabwe for 3.5 weeks. I wanted to go there just to see the resilience. Of because when I was at Silhane, those people that had their farms taken off them, so just wanted to see their resilience of people. But they're such a happy, what we saw, they're all happy, happy nation. But there's obviously a lot going on behind the scenes, and people tried to draw me into speaking about it, but it's not my knowledge to,
I
it's
like
not my
to
culture to
sure, yeah.
speak about. So I've always been a bit cagey, but we had a really good time. We were there with a lot of two Zim guys that showed us around and really did showcase Zimbabwe.
Is it, and this is don't this isn't going to be an intrusive question at all. Is it, are they in the position to be, I don't think the word's reclaiming, but to get farms back, or is that not where it is? Not
I
really.
don't think so. It's so volatile. It just
Yeah.
depends. Like I said, the people, like we had it, I guess we just saw the highs
For
when we
sure.
were there. There is some of it, but then you read again, and then you speak to the Zim guys, and they're saying no, it's a long way off. I don't
Yeah.
know. But
Yeah.
I had, we saw a mobile dairy there. A guy who was a second farmer's son, so saw early on there's no progression at home because the oldest son had it, and he'd gone out there and risked everything and was really making a go of it. And so then I looked at a location because I was like, well. Everyone's neighbor's son comes home and looks at thinks a neighbor's going to sell. But the thing is, his son is looking at your farm thinking you're going to sell, and you spend your whole life waiting for that person's opportunity. But the location in the Zim was just like, I'm not saying go to Zim and be a dairy farmer, I'm saying you've got to look at location, and you've got to be not arrogant enough that you're going to be on your doorstep. You need to be prepared to move for the right opportunity.
Yes,
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I can't remember if it was on or off recording that you were saying about someone else. Oh, it was you, sorry, doing a Nuffield at the start. For the Nuffield or for a topic. And I think I've said it a few times, like, you've got to do Nuffield, you've got to do moving to Zimbabwe for the right reason, not just because to tick a box in your head of going around. Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree.
Yeah, and then we went to Australia, and that's when this marketing, because we just keep producing stuff, and we're just saying, "Can you please pay me for it?" And this woman that milked 8 cows, and her aspirations were to milk 9, and I just like nearly fell over. And I was like 19, because nine. And I was like, when people ask me, I was like, "Yeah, 400. I want to milk 400 cows. Yeah, that's where I'm going." And she had a waiting list to sell her milk. She had 3 months in advance. We paid up front for, which is like unheard of. Yeah, waiting there. She had a mobile pilot she built out of scrap, like a tin roof. Rented 50 acres in a market garden, and just looked. My system is very peaceful in the summer. It's a lovely, idyllic way to milk cows. But then she just took it to another level because they had the calves on them. Like, she ticked every box. No one could question the ethics or sustainability or anything about that system. Yeah, that was my pin drop moment of like, anyone could go and rent 50 acres and sell that milk to the village. Like, you may not be rich, you then open that, or you open that communication trail for the public that probably would bolt on to something else.
But we've got such a disconnect in this country. Such a disconnect.
I'm telling you, any village, especially down here, if you set up outside the village with 10 cows and said, "Could I buy your milk?" you would have a queue of people. And then once you've got that connection, you don't know where that they might have an uncle that or a son that has 10 acres, or then you become the Amazon driver because you deliver other stuff, and before you know it, like, your mind's open to what you could. You might have started on milking cows, but you've gone into this whole different market that you didn't know about, because everyone's used to having everything delivered now. There's like 20 Amazon vans come through our village a day. So there's no reason why he couldn't deliver, because your food's delivered, he could deliver stuff on the back of the milk. It's endless what you could do, or you could start showing people around. People teach people to milk, education things, all from the back of 8 cows. Whereas when I was trying to farm, I was like, well, it's not viable 8 cows. I've got to have 100 cows. I've got to have 200 cows. It needs to be big. It needs to be scale. And I've just learned so much that the marketing is something that just opened my mind that we completely miss. And it's such an art to it. It's not something you can just read in a book. It's so, I don't know. I take my hat off to anyone who does marketing.
One of our year scholars, Natalie Hepburn, her topic, now I can't remember the exact term or whatever, but is basically creating a product out of what we produce. Now she's looking at what she does in particular, but in general, and you're right, but we're so far behind. We're in a complete perfect competition market that we have absolutely no power over what we produce. No power over the price of what we produce, sorry. And it's, I don't know how long that can continue without folk really caring, because it doesn't feel like they do, which is interesting, worrying. So Zimbabwe and Australia, is that, sorry.
So I took the family to Australia for a month, because when we got the Nuffield again, it was a condition that we went on a family holiday. So I was thinking like somewhere in Europe, but no, she wanted to go to Australia. So we took the two kids, had a camper van for a month and traveled around and saw a few farms, but it was kind of a bit of a family holiday as well. So yeah, that was great. That was over Christmas time. And then where else to go? So then I went to Denver in America. So there was a regenerate conference that they wanted us to do a Zoom talk on, and then we said we were no good on Zoom. We'd like to do it in person, so they flew us out there
Excellent.
to talk at this conference, which is really quite eye-opening in itself, because that was a room full of regenerative soul people. Searching Christ Bible, God,
it.
the whole thing was built around that. And when you look back at it, it's like, yeah, it probably would have been a bit, it was a bit too far out there for me. It's like singing in the morning before the conference and
Right.
stuff. And then we had like breakout sessions that I was involved in. And then there's a lot of older generation farmers there. They're all obsessed by owning land. You have to
Right.
own the land. And then at the end, we were talking about half an hour, and then it was like Q&A, and this man stood up and pointed at me, and he goes, "The trouble with you is, Ollie, you're not a farmer, you're a businessman." And I said, "Yeah, I am." I said, "I can't be a farmer if I'm not a businessman, because I can't be sustainable. Like, there has to be profit in it to farm the land properly." Because he kept saying I wasn't looking after the land. I was like, "Yeah, but if I haven't got any money, I can't look after the land." And I said, "Well, I take that as a compliment."
He's like flying these idiots out here. Did you, we've got to make
Yeah,
money.
exactly.
No, you can't be doing that nonsense.
Out of that trip, I booked a week. It was only like a 2 day conference, but I booked a week and I thought I'd see what happens. And I met a guy in a lobby from California that was going out, going over the Rockies somewhere to look at a 90,000 hectare ranch, basically, that had burnt, 80% of it burnt. And he said, "Do you want to come with me?" Because, like I mentioned, Nuffield, and he had this connection. And all I know, I'm in a car with a bloke for 6 hours chatting about the whole of the world. Fascinating guy. Tomcat Ranch he's from. We still speak now. And that was eye-watering to see climate change. Like, they had this, when it rains now, because the forest is all burnt, nothing's holding the debris back. So it's just all coming down through the gorge. And it's washed all this gorge out that was probably my height, which is probably now 20 foot deep. So they have the same problems we've got. And then, like, all their governments are telling them that they can build beavers. They introduce beavers to dam it all up. But the trouble is, when it rains, there's no stopping the flow, and the poor beavers just get washed away.
All right.
Yeah. So they're saying, like, if we can get an excavator in here and help the beaver, like, to build it up first. But no, you can't have machines in here. It needs to be all natural. Natural regeneration, and it's just, oh, it's crying out for like some common sense. Then I learned there that you can, so they're getting goats in there. I think they had 9,000 goats, but you hire a goat. So I thought that's a really good business, though. A really good business is you can have 90,000 goats, but you hire them out 12 months a year on someone else's farm and get paid for them. I was like, I'm just going to be a goat farmer, because you're not actually a goat farmer.
Hiring them out for
To
them.
eat the gorse back,
Sorry, got you.
so this land they're trying to regenerate. So they've got the 90,000 hectares. They've got 300 Angus cows on it, and it used to have like 6 or 7,000
For
cows.
sure, yeah.
So they're trying to regenerate that back on, but there's not the food there. But you need the cows there as a trampoline to regenerate it and start the whole cycle. So it's like catch 22. What do you get first? So they're bringing a lot of food in and trampling a lot of it, but then the gorge is so thick they're getting the goats in there to eat it all out.
It's a
But they're
brilliant
hiring the
business
goats.
model. Genius, is it not?
Yeah, so it's, again, so nothing will take you, and I encourage you to go and see your subject, go and see something, like, be open to anything, because you'll be amazed what you find on these little random rabbit holes you go down. It's nothing to do with my subject, but like, it turned out that, oh, you could actually, like, yeah, be a goat farmer and hire goats out. Oh, that's quite an interesting, something, like, another business opportunity there for someone.
I'd planned for Nuffield to be, I'll basically book the flights there and back, and then we'll see what happens. And I spoke to about two people, in particular Holland, shout out Bianca Koorn and Karina van der Baker. They were like, "Oh, grand, you're coming over. Do you want a place to stay? We'll sort your room. Oh, and we've just booked things for you to do Monday through Thursday. Have you got in for Friday? We'll make something for Friday." And I'm like, "Wait a minute." How can I thank you? It's amazing.
They do. They just want to. They want to showcase what they do. Yeah, I didn't. I had very few booked in. Because you'll find you're just that one person will probably give you 20 contacts, and then before you know it, you don't see that person. You have to let that person down because you just run out of time. So I just left it open to go.
That's why I hadn't originally planned to timetable it, but it has now been done.
No, don't.
Couple of
I
days
mean,
ago.
people do. People and I, it depends what sort of person you are. People had it all regimented time scale, but I just went loose and just
I think
let
that's
it
my
take
plan
you.
for my bigger one, which is like Asia and New Zealand. It's my
Yep.
plan to do that and maybe a few things in. But
Yeah, Holland. I went to Holland. That was yeah, I like that. I went to an ed educational farm there. I'll try and dig that out for you actually and send that through. That was interesting.
was that Even Ho Eve Ian
Yes, it might be a girl.
Judith.
Oh, I can't remember who it was, but
Oh.
on the back of that, we've now got internships coming over.
Excellent.
So I've had this German guy came for 8 weeks last year on the back of that.
Yeah.
He's come back now for 3 weeks with another German girl. And then this I've got another Dutch guy coming in July to do 8 weeks.
Amazing.
So on the back of that, I've got this internship, which I thought was great because it's good to, and it's good for the people, the English people that work with me here.
Yep.
I sent Nina out to Germany for Christmas for a week just to see what
Oh, brilliant.
is on there. So I'm just trying to connect everything.
Yeah, that's the amazing things, the connection side.
Yeah.
You're all, it's been great fun. It's been good.
Sorry,
Quite
I've
interesting.
already rambled on. I didn't
Not at
it's
all, mate. Not at all. You listen to someone for 10 minutes trying to be very intense and say, this is what's happening. And then they get some questions from folk about really random things. And then, yeah, you don't really get to sort of dig deep. So, no, I appreciate it. It's been really good to chat. I don't know if you've listened to one of these podcasts before,
No.
but there is one thing I do with everyone before I let anyone go, and it's ask them two questions, one of which is a horrible one because it's really hard to know the answer. But the questions are, one, if you, well, sorry, where would you see yourself in 5 years? And the second one is probably aimed perfectly at yourself, and that's if you had any advice for people coming into farming, what would it be?
So coming into farming, I would very much have a plan and write it down. It might change as you progress, but understand what you want before you do it
Yeah.
would be so. Like I had my 5 goals, as such when I set it out, and like as a dairy progress, and then it, like they change a bit, like your life goals or your business goals, but very much have that written down, I
Okay.
think. And where do I see myself in 5 years? Hopefully still what we're doing. More so I'm really desperate after the Australian, like the marketing, is to try and get to the consumer with a product. So I've been very careful, like that it we're at Arla, we've got a great contract. They pay me once a month for my milk, and it's like 1.2 million liters. So there's a lot of milk to ship, and well,
Yeah.
I'm never going to be brave enough to step out, but you never know what comes around the corner. But just to tiptoe into that community market, because I just think we've got a great product that we're underselling.
A lot of liters.
Yeah, so we might just start with we can sell like there's some rules in Ireland that you can sell a little bit. So we might start making a cheese or a yogurt or
Right.
something.
Okay.
Just I just it's a bit of fun. It gets us into a different circle of people.
Yeah.
So it might open up other enterprises onto Kingsford Estates.
Yeah.
And it's just getting to that consumer and telling the story.
Your market from that individual liter of milk goes from pennies to pounds, literally.
Oh yes, yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. Definitely. But it is a skill set to do. It's not something you can just take, if I want to do it, I'm going to do it properly. I'm doing a lot of research about that. So yeah, you may see
Excellent.
me. I don't know if I hit supermarkets,
Yeah, that's
but
it. No, very good, mate. Very good. Here, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you. Thank you for your time.
no, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Take it out of an evening. For those of you listening, that's been Ollie Chedji's story. Quite an interesting one. And yeah, very much one that two or three stuck out to me of the ones we watched in Exeter, and yours was definitely up there, even if it was that you were offending my topic or if it was, no, it absolutely wasn't. That story about the lady whose, again, country I got wrong, but it was very interesting. So, no, very good. And the last episode we had was Toby, who was on the same cohort as Ollie. Another great story there. And it's just quite a fun story away from Nuffield as well in Toby's life, with military and whatnot. Quite a cool story there. Next one, I have no idea what we're talking about. It's about rocks. So, Louisa, I'm sure I'll keep Ed and I going. We'll have absolutely no idea what's happening. I am going to learn a fun fact about rocks so I can impress her, and that's about all I have. So yeah, I hope you're enjoying the R2 cast. We are, well, what's that, 17 episodes away from 200, which will mean that is 2 months away. So yeah, we're releasing a lot of episodes. So we'll be seeing you in April for the big 200. If you have any ideas of someone you'd want to see for that, please get in touch. Previous anniversary ones we've had are Adam Henson for the 25th, Emma and Ewan, or Emma Gray and Ewan Irvine for the 50th, and an Olympian for the 150th. Who was 100? Oh yeah, 100 was me. That was rubbish. So yeah, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all for number 184. See you then.
I hope you've enjoyed another excellent episode of the R2 cast as much as I have, and I would just like to quickly thank our primary sponsors of the show today, Howden Rural, the new name for A-Plan Rural. If you follow Howden Rural on social media, you'll see the plethora of work that they do to support this sector, and it's been a pleasure to work alongside them so far, and long may it continue. For more information about them, be sure to check out howdeninsurance.co.uk/rural, and I'll see you for the next episode.